Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, November 30th. With us now is John Podesta, who, among many other things, was White House Chief of Staff under President Bill Clinton, leader of the Obama-Biden transition team in 2008, chairman of the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign in 2016, and founder of the think tank, the Center for American Progress. And his Twitter feed says, "Don't blame others for my opinions." John, nice to have you on again. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be back on with you, Brian.
I'll start with an easy one. You're excited about John Kerry's appointment, I saw, which puts a climate change policymaker in a cabinet-level position. If you accept that Barack Obama, as president, took climate seriously, what difference do you think this new position could make for actual climate policy?
Well, look, I think Joe Biden during the campaign made the climate crisis and investments to deal with that crisis central to his economic policy and his environmental policy. I think what this signal sends is that it'll also be central to his security policy and foreign policy. And someone with John Kerry's stature can really be a catalyst for what is particularly in a very important year in 2021, as we during the lead up to the Conference of Parties, the so-called COP in Glasgow, which will occur towards the end of the year, to try to bring the world to greater ambition. That's what we need in order to solve the climate crisis. We're not on track even to hit a 2-degree rise in global average temperatures, and we have to go a lot further. We have to, as Biden and Harris recognized in the campaign, by mid-century, we have to have a net zero economy, no emissions that are not made up for by taking essentially CO2 out of the atmosphere. So that's a huge task, but it's a global task, and it's going to require a diplomat of both Kerry's experience and depth, also the fact that he's so passionate about climate change, to bring that community, the global community, together and increase ambition across the board. You know, the U.S. has been out of the game for 4 years. Now we're very much back in the game, I think.
Now, you're obviously a Democratic Party insider, and the cabinet, as it's shaping up, to some people's relief and some people's dismay, is filled with a lot of what look like fairly conventional choices to a lot of people. Why should people be excited about this?
Well, look, I think they've chosen experience over, just bringing in somebody new for the sake of bringing in someone new. And I think there are people who can get things done. I think Biden understands that, again, we have these simultaneous crises with COVID, with the recession, with the climate, as we've spoken about, and with racial justice. And he wants an experienced team that can move the whole of government, you know, every cabinet agency to its highest ambition. And I think that's what we've seen. Yesterday, of course, he appointed two of my good friends and people I work with, Neera Tanden, to direct the Office of Management and Budget, and Heather Boucher, who runs the Washington Center on Equitable Growth, to the Council of Economic Advisors. I mean, they're both strong progressives. They have experience in being in Washington, but they've always pushed the party towards greater ambition and really solving the problems of working people. So I think if you look at the people he put out yesterday, this communications team, as I tweeted, women rule. I mean, it's a really exciting group of people, and I think they'll do a great job for the country.
Jen Psaki as press secretary, and other women on this all-women communications team leadership. About people being insiders, though, one issue regarding some of Biden's nominees revolves around two companies, West Exec and Pine Island Capital, that use, and one of them has boasted about using, their ties to Washington insiders to get things for their investors. And as the New York Times reports, West Exec's founders include Antony Blinken, Biden's choice for Secretary of State, and Michelle Flournoy, one of the leading candidates to be his defense secretary, Avril Haines, nominated to be director of national intelligence, and Jennifer Psaki, now named as press secretary. What should progressives or good government watchdogs concerned about corporate influence in D.C. think about this? Why isn't this the swamp?
Well, I'm not going to defend the swamp, but I will defend the individuals. I think they're people of high integrity. I think that, you know, puts a premium on complete and total disclosure. And I think that's what should be expected of candidates going into government. And, you know, like I think that we would do well if we kind of broke the cycle of people going from the government into places of influence in the private sector. But that's what it is. I don't think that those individuals, though, are people who are anything but 100% honorable, and I think they'll do a great job. They will, you know, I think be under greater scrutiny because of the associations that you noted. But I think they're up for that total disclosure, complete severance, and the ability to operate in the interest of the United States and not of their former clients. You know, I think if you, I'll give you a contrast. If you look at what, and again, I spend most of my time on climate change and the environment these days. Mm-hmm. If you look at the people Trump brought in, he brought in a bunch of lobbyists for the fossil fuel industry. And then what did they do? They proceeded to do favors for the fossil fuel industry.
Yes, but that's a low bar.
Well, you know, but I think I agree with that it's a low bar. But I think that that's the standard that you have to look at. Are they tilting the playing field in any way to help what could be viewed as their former clients? I don't think they will, and I think they have to be held accountable to that. But, you know, I know that reporters will be looking for that, so I think they understand that they have to be squeaky clean in, when they're in office.
And Republican Senator Tom Cotton says Biden's Homeland Security nominee, Alejandro Mayorkas, was found by President Obama's inspector general to be guilty of selling green cards to Chinese nationals on behalf of rich Democratic donors. That's a quote from a Tom Cotton tweet. If that's true, that would make it hard to make him the guy in charge of immigration. Do you know if it's true?
No, it's not true. And I think, you know, Tom Cotton says all kinds of things in his Twitter feed, most of them outrageous. But Ali Mayorkas, who's will be the first immigrant to lead the department, did an outstanding job. I go back with him to the Clinton administration, where he's a U.S. attorney in San Diego. He served with distinction and honor for President Obama, and you know, there is a program there that permits people to invest in the United States and receive green cards. That's a program that was enacted by the Congress that that Senator Cotton serves in. So I think if you have to look at what's wrong with immigration policy, it might start at home rather than casting false aspersions on the incoming nominee.
And that's a policy that you probably think is ripe for reform. I've certainly heard of that before, where people with a certain amount of money to invest in the U.S., that becomes a criteria for a quick path to a green card, and a number of people from China have taken advantage of it. But you're saying if people look more closely at this, that they will not find that Mr. Mayorkas, quote, sold green cards to Chinese nationals in any way that is outside the parameters of that policy?
Yes. And I think that, you know, again, he didn't sell green cards. The Congress set up this program. And if I had my druthers, I'd get rid of it. You know, I think there's a point in having a skill-based immigration system, so you're attracting talent to the United States. You know, this seems to me to be, you know, outside the normal bounds of what we think of as good immigration policy, and yet it exists in the law, and Congress has, has enacted it. I think that investors flock to the United States for a lot of reasons, but I think getting a green card shouldn't be one of them.
Do you think that Biden can set up any kind of comprehensive immigration reform? He said he's going to propose something in his first 100 days that could get more traction in, let's assume, a Republican Senate than past efforts did, even when they had John McCain and Marco Rubio and a few others on board. Would it be something that includes a more merit-based legal immigration system, which is exactly what Trump was aiming for and what Tom Cotton wants, that along with the path to citizenship? I'm just making this up, but is there a road that you can imagine?
Well, you know, I think he's certainly going to try to stimulate that conversation by proposing legislation in its first 100 days, comprehensive reform that provides legal status for the people who are here and provides them with a path to citizenship, you know, so long as they meet certain criteria. And I think that would be, you know, Obama tried to do it. Obviously, President Bush tried to do it. In those days, they had support from the Senate and found it vexing to get it through the House of Representatives. In Bush's case, he had support in the House, but it was blocked on a filibuster in the Senate. So I think there has in the past been bipartisan support for comprehensive reform. And I think Biden will make this a priority and try to see if he can find a group of Republicans in the Senate who he can work with towards that end. Whether McConnell wants to play ball with that or not, you know, we'll have to wait and see. And we'll also have to wait and see the outcome of the two Georgia special Senate elections that are coming January 5th. If the Democrats win those seats, which is given that Biden won the state, quite plausible, then he's in a different situation with Chuck Schumer as leader of the Senate.
Marcia in Queens, you're on WNYC with John Podesta. Hello, Marcia.
Oh, hi. My concern is the transition of this sitting president. He's kind of in a corner right now. Everything is turning away from him for his plan to stay in place. I wonder if this quote-unquote war that appears to be starting between Iran and Israel, it's not there. Hopefully it won't happen, because that would allow this president, who supports Israel, to declare martial law in this country. And then the transition, is it possible that that wouldn't happen?
Wow. Well, John, you go ahead.
Look,
you
start. I think he's been so erratic. You know, he's living in a world of self-pity and conspiracy these days, and kind of graceless in accepting the loss. And you know, it's I think doing damage really to the democracy by convincing a lot of people that that somehow the Biden's win was the product of massive frauds when there's absolutely zero evidence of that. And even the judges he appointed are throwing out this, you know, dumpster fire versus of election cases out the door. So I think he is in a corner. He can't accept defeat. The interviews that he has done, the press conference he did on Thanksgiving, kind of reflect that. But worrying is that he is the commander in chief, and you know, his minions in the White House are going about. They fired Secretary Esper, the Secretary of Defense. He's kind of installed his apparatchiks in important positions, including in the Defense Department, and in other spots, senior spots in the government. So I think it bears watching. I'm not relieving the worry of the caller, because I'm worried too, actually.
Do you think that with the rumors that were around or press reports that Trump had considered at least an attack on Iran during the transition period. And I think when people read that, or maybe when sources said that to reporters, they were thinking more of some kind of bombing run, but that this assassination of one of their top nuclear scientists, which Iran so far seems to be blaming on Israel, whether that's true or not, we don't know, could have actually been a Trump-ordered assassination as, you know, one of his, either one of his last parting shots against Iran after leaving the nuclear deal and trying to leave Joe Biden in a difficult position, ratcheting up tensions just as the transition is taking place, or worse, trying to get us into a war in the way that the caller asks.
Well, look, I think that there's no way for us to know that, but it does call out the fact that it's only today that Joe Biden is getting access to the president's daily brief, the most important collection of intelligence and threat analysis facing the country. And I'm sure that PDB is full of information gleaned from our best intelligence sources about what happened or what we are likely to surmise about what happened in Iran. I would say, I think, again, to not go off too far in the direction of Mad King George, as the Washington Post described the president over the weekend.
Oh, you say Mad King George. You know, there's a funny satire out. You could find it on the web, of Trump as King George from Hamilton. So if people know that musical number, you could think about that. And if it's not overly creepy, you'll find it funny. John, I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish your thought.
Anyways, his national security advisor, Robert O'Brien, has, you know, indicated that he wants to work with the incoming Biden team. And I think the indications from the Biden team are that there is cooperation at every level, and particularly from the career personnel in these national security and intelligence agencies. And I think he will at least try to restrain whimsical action by the president. But again, you know, the president is the president; he is the commander in chief. So I think hopefully the advice he's getting from his own team, including Mr. O'Brien, but also from Republicans on Capitol Hill, is don't do anything provocative on your way out the door. You know, these are options that should be left to an administration that's been duly elected by the people of the United States.
One more call for John Podesta. Spencer in Berkeley Heights, you're on WNYC. Hello, Spencer.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning, Mr. Podesta.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. My question has to do with incoming President-elect Biden's very large tent for everyone to, you know, congregate under. As an earlier caller had commented on criticizing from the further left perspective about how the supposed swamp is coming back to settle, how does President-elect Biden walk that fine line to make certain that the Democrats are in power for more than just one term, to placate to further left, further progressives that feel that the needle hasn't been moved enough, versus the moderates and the anti-Trump Republicans that tend to vacillate back and forth because they feel that either because of marketing or personal preference that the policies that are being implemented aren't to their liking. President Obama came into power. One of the first things that he did, his major piece of legislation for public health care, became a lightning rod that resulted in a change of the legislative composition for the Democrats that they've had to try and undo now for 8 years. They were close to 8 years, and they're still in power, but certainly that is tenuous depending upon what the president-elect does once he's in office.
Well, look, I think the most important thing is performance. He's got to get the virus under control. He's got to get, hopefully, the positive news we're seeing from Pfizer and Moderna means that we will have a vaccine out there. There are others coming along that we can get back to some semblance of normal, put people back to work, and then make the kind of investments he talked about during the campaign. Investments in clean energy to deal with climate change, and investments in child care and elder care to make sure that families can succeed. If he can get that done, and to some extent, particularly in the climate arena, he may have to do that with or without the help of the Congress. He may have to do a lot of that using the authorities he has and the authorities that agencies have to move that along. But if he can show that he, the central promise of his campaign, which is I'm going to care about the middle class, I'm going to improve your life, I'm going to get you to back to work, and where you, if you've been unemployed and where you are employed, I'm going to improve job standards and try to increase wages. If that's the focus and of his attention, and he brings people in who ultimately are effective in getting that done, that's pretty good politics in the end of the day. But I think if you're focused on Twitter, you're going to get lost. The one thing about Biden, and I think it surprised a lot of people through the primaries and through the general election, is he had a game plan. He stayed focused on it. He didn't get pushed around by what wars were going on Twitter. He said, I got a job to do, both to restore the decency of America, but to refocus on the big challenges, racial justice, the climate crisis, the health crisis, and the economic crisis. And that's what he's got to deliver on.
But last question then, as a follow-up, if Republicans hold the Senate, is there any path to getting Mitch McConnell not to be a complete rejectionist like he was under Obama, leaving Biden to only do what he can do through executive action?
Well, you know, I think there are places where they can, where even with them in control, with the Republicans in control, again, I'm hopeful that we can win those Georgia seats. That'd be a lot better. But if we don't prevail there and Republicans hold on to the Senate, I think there are places like green infrastructure, certainly pandemic relief, support to reopen the schools, support for really relieve the burdens that have been caused by COVID-19 on the healthcare system overall. I think, McConnell knows Biden, but Biden knows McConnell too. And I think he knows how to pressure him into at least acting in the interests of the country once in a while. McConnell's all about power, but he can be influenced. I don't think a Republican-led Senate is going to do the same thing that a Democratic-led Senate would do. For example, Biden has pledged to repeal the high-end Trump tax cuts. Probably that's not in the offing if McConnell's the leader. Almost certainly can't get that done. But I think there are investments that can be made, big boost in R&D, both in the health space as well as in the energy and climate space. Those are things I think you can get the a Republican-led Senate to go along with if you prioritize and you put pressure on them and you don't take no for an answer.
John Podesta, thanks so much for giving us some time this morning. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Don.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.